Hi again, everybody. John Porteous of the Lovells Township Historical Society here, and you're listening to the Backcast Podcast. Hey, welcome back, everyone. Time for another episode. This week, Richard and I are sitting down with a pretty neat guy. His name's Jim Schottenham, and he's the curator of the American Museum of Fly Fishing. Aside from those responsibilities, he also has a passion for early American reels, so we'll hear a little bit about that. He's a fun guy, and I think you'll enjoy this conversation. So without further ado, here we go.
Well, hey, Jim. Welcome. Richard Perry, Alan, and I, we're delighted to be joined by you today, Jim, and we're excited to, I guess, touch on a plethora of topics today. Why don't we start by having you tell our listeners kind of how you came to fly fishing or fishing to start, and then kind of tell us a little bit about your home waters and influences and such.
Well, certainly. Well, first, thanks very much for having me. I appreciate it, and good afternoon to all of you. So my name, of course, is Jim Schottenham. I'm currently the curator at the American Museum of Fly Fishing, with its main campus in Manchester, Vermont. So you had asked about my influences. I can actually trace those back to 1967 when I was 5 years old. And I can remember very clearly my grandmother was kind enough to take me on a fishing trip off the shores of New Hampshire, at Hampton Beach in particular, and on a boat run by a company named Smith & Gilmore. And I was so excited to get out on that water, and I remember being completely distraught that they would not give a five-year-old a rod and reel. So my fishing consisted of using a hand line dropped over the side of the boat. And even at the age of five, I can remember looking longingly at all the other anglers that had a rod and reel. It didn't hamper my success. I still managed to catch a few sand sharks. I enjoyed every minute of it, but I think that desire to use a rod and reel probably fueled my future endeavors as a collector.
That's awesome.
So my family, going back to my great-grandfather, I have a photograph in my office of my great-grandfather and my grandmother with her two sisters, all of which are holding fish that they caught. And the garb back then, of course, my great-grandfather was wearing a tie, a sport coat or suit jacket, if you will. My grandmother and her sister all in their dresses, and all of them holding a fish. My grandfather had a smile on his face that clearly displayed just how proud he was of his family for doing that. So I think fishing has been in my family for a very long time.
I love stories like that, Jim. That's awesome. Start early and keep at it.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that's the thing. My grandmother, certainly seeing how excited I was to go out on the water, she continued to take me out there, but she also used to stop at a pond in New Hampshire, right along the highway that that we used to take when we'd visit family that lived in Nashua. And she would, without fail, stop at that little pond on the roadside, take out her old Fluger casting rod, a little Fluger skill cast reel, and let me fish from shore for all the panfish, bluegills, sunnies, and that sort of thing. And I really looked forward to those outings. I really did. I still, in fact, have her rod and reel that, despite all the great things I have in my collection, those probably mean more to me than anything else that I have. Not the most valuable by far, but to me, they're very special.
So they carry all those intangible sentimental values, and that's that makes it super special.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
So I spent a fair amount of time with family traveling and vacationing up in the Adirondack. So I experienced my first smallmouth bass. I think it was on Scroon Lake. And anyone that's caught a smallmouth on Scroon Lake can tell you they're an incredibly hard-fighting fish. I spent quite a bit of time trout fishing on some of the streams up in the Adirondacks and southern Adirondacks in particular. Used to love catching pretty much anything. So bass fishing really kind of was the focus of my attention in my 20s. I started fishing some local and regional bass tournaments. Enjoyed doing that. but continued fishing saltwater, fishing for trout. I remember the first time that I was introduced to salmon and steelhead fishing. It leaves an impression when crossing the Salmon River in Pulaski, New York for the first time back in the 1980s, the fish were so plentiful that they would just about knock you off your feet because they were running into your legs as you crossed.
That's incredible.
And not to get too boring, but I remember very clearly, as I'm sure most fly anglers will, I remember the first fish that I caught on a fly that I tied myself. It was a 14.5-pound steelhead on the Salmon River. And that fish, I'll never forget that experience. I was just so happy. So angling has been with me all my life, and I don't get to do as much of it as I'd like to now, but it doesn't mean that the desire is not still there. I'm actually looking forward to a trip this coming June to chase some stripers on Cape Cod. So,
oh, there you go.
That's to look forward to.
I can't help but believe that the your situation with the museum presents you with some unique opportunities that way as well, perhaps.
Some of the events that the museum has, they do have some member-only events that will introduce you to some pretty unique fly fishing locations. But it's more about the people that I've had the opportunity to meet since joining the museum staff. And in fact, I could trace that back. I've been very fortunate in that my profession matches my passion for collecting. There's very few people that get to do that, to get to do something that they truly love to do. So as a job, I get to study the history of fishing. I get to interact with the people that created that history. I get to learn about the people that came before us. That introduced a lot of the methods and techniques, and plus I get to play with antique tackle. So I don't know how you can beat that.
Yeah, no, it's a pretty swell thing when you can. To your point, there aren't that many people that can offer that glowing endorsement. Yeah. So I got to ask, did your grandmother put you onto your first fly rod?
No, she didn't put me on to. She wasn't much of a fly fisher. She was more of a general line angler, I would say.
Okay.
My first experience with a fly rod came on the west branch of the Sagandaga when I caught my first trout with a fly rod, and that was something I just kind of picked up on my own. I enjoyed fishing. It didn't matter to me what it was. And,
okay.
And I have to say I'm not. Strictly a fly angler today. I still enjoy bass fishing. I enjoy saltwater fishing, although I have taken to using a fly rod on the salt. That's a lot of fun catching those stripers on a fly rod.
We've heard some friends that go out to New York to chase those and have a great deal of fun with their fly rods. Good stuff. And again, this it's kind of rare air for us. I think you're the first individual affiliated with any formal museum that we've had on. So, and in that sense, you're as the curator, you're kind of new and full time in this role. Is that correct?
Yeah, it is. So prior to joining the museum staff, I served as president of the Old Reel Collectors Association, my career at the time was an IT manager for a local hospital here in upstate New York. I had an opportunity early on to leave the hospital and join the staff at Lang's Tackle Auction. And for those that are unfamiliar, Lang's is the world's largest antique tackle organization, antique tackle auction house. And I had the privilege of handling probably more old tackle, in particular old reels, than anyone on the planet. I've studied and held tens of thousands of reels over my 15-year career with them. And that led to an opportunity at the American Museum of Fly Fishing and I joined them at the beginning of the year in 2022, and I've enjoyed my time there ever since.
Well, then, but not a new cold relationship. If I'm not mistaken, did you actually do a real presentation for them a couple of years ago?
I did. I've done a number of things with the museum. Back in the day, we did an appraisal day for them. I was a member, as a member of the museum, I participated in something that they called a Rare Real Rendezvous. And that was kind of an interesting day. There were members of the museum brought their own private collections to display inside the museum space. And I had the good fortune of sharing the building that day with a gentleman named Jim Brown. For those that may be unfamiliar, Jim actually authored a book titled A Treasury of Reels, and that's all about the museum's collection of reels. Jim has been an instrumental part in my collecting. He has written a number of books on the subject, and it was great. It was a great deal of fun spending the day with him and other collectors, sharing all of our private collections with the museum, and that was a lot of fun too. I served as a guest curator before joining the staff. I have brought my own collection of side-mounted fly reels to the museum and had an exhibit up for, oh, I forget how long. It was up for quite a while. It was just before COVID.
Wow. So what's your favorite old reel?
Boy, that's a tough thing. My collecting focus has been on side-mounted fly reels. Mostly they were made in upstate New York, where I'm from. So they have the age. They started in the 1850s. The side-mounted reels were produced up until around 1900. So I've got the location, I've got the history, and I think they're just totally unique and somewhat misunderstood. So it's perfect for me to be able to collect those and try to educate people about what they are so that they don't unfortunately end up in a landfill because people don't know what they are.
I don't know. An antique reel for me is like a head and auto winder, you know.
Yeah, well, the automatic fly reel was first patented in 1880 by a gentleman named Francis Loomis, who was from New York. He brought on a partner in 1881, and Loomis and Plum evolved into Yaman and Irby, and of course, I'm sure a lot of people are familiar with the Martin Reel Company, which started in 1897. Or no, 1887, I believe, 1890s. So, yeah, there's a lot of history here in upstate New York when it comes to old reels.
I think I got a box back there someplace that got a couple old Martins in it. I don't wonder, Perrine?
Perrine.
Perrine, yes. There's a couple of those around for some point. I used to get those if I'd look on eBay in places. If they looked like they had a silk line on them, I'd buy them.
Just to get that silk line. Sure.
About every third one would turn out something you could recondition and actually use, you know, or would be usable if you was crazy enough to use it.
Yeah.
Use it for parts.
Yeah. But I got quite an impressive pile of auto winders around here.
Well, you know, there's a number of pretty unique examples, like I said, that people still collect today. The earliest that Francis Loomis was an all hard rubber sided reel, and it was pretty unique. And the one thing that I try to impress upon people that are unfamiliar with the automatics, there's a misconception amongst the general public that an automatic reel is cheating, that the reel would be used to bring the fish to hand, and that's simply not the case. Those automatic reels were intended to bring all of that loose line that a fly fisher would strip from the reel and have hanging at their feet. It was intended to bring all that loose line back on the reel so that you could fight the fish without having to worry about tripping or having a knot form and breaking your line and losing that fish.
Well, yeah, the story I've heard around here is they were popular with the guys because they could, back in the old days, the guys would fish, and they could manage the line and manage the boat, you know, one-handed each.
Sure.
Well, we've got, you guys, I think you enjoy a pretty prestigious membership in your museum, and you know, we have a lot of welcome and great membership guys in ours, but I think you got kind of the cream of the crop that shows up to your events and things.
Well, we're an international. We have a number of members from all over the world, and in fact, I can tell you emphatically that years and years ago, the museum changed its name purposely to be more inclusive. So I believe, if memory serves, it was called the Museum of American Fly Fishing, and it just had the connotation that it was only about the American fly fisher, and changing it to the American Museum of Fly Fishing was more inclusive. So, of course, in our holdings, we have a number of things from England and Europe and Asia and all over the world. So it's all inclusive. It's not just tackle in America, but from everywhere.
I'm sure. I know you got an impressive membership because Alan Deodor here is with us today. Him and I are both members, so that, you know, that opens up the line. Yeah. Are you and John as well? Yeah.
So. Your reach extends to the Great Lakes.
Yeah, if you can get the level township
out here to the hinterland.
Well, you know, the other thing that we were fortunate enough to do this past year in 2022, the museum opened up a campus in Springfield, Missouri. And it's within the building that encompasses the Wonders of Wildlife and the Bass Pro Shops flagship store in Springfield, Missouri. So if any of your listeners have an opportunity to make it down there, I certainly invite you to go in and take a look around at our campus down there, free admission. We've got a tremendous selection of artifacts down there and tell quite a bit of history based on some of the things that we have.
Is it an extension of all things, the museum, or is it more focused on angling in that area?
No, it's all-encompassing. So we have, as part of that exhibit, we have a timeline that starts from around 200 AD all the way into the 2000s. There are a number of wall panels that celebrate presidential anglers, celebrity anglers, notable fly tiers. We have some film components. We have highlight reels of both Lefty Cray and Joan Wolf casting when you first enter the building. We have some selections of the 20 most influential fly fishing films that are available on one of the walls. There's an art exhibit, rod exhibit, reel exhibit. There's quite a bit to see down there.
That sounds wonderful.
Is that list of movies on the online available online any place? I'd like to see that.
So if you're a member of the American Museum, one of the benefits of membership is access to what we have. It's called our screening room. And there's a large number of films that are available for viewing at any time. And I'll tell you, I think that's worth the price of membership alone. There's some great films there. As far as what's available currently, the selection of movies or short films, rather, rotate. So I don't want to tell you that if you travel all the way down to Springfield to see something in particular, it'll be playing. You can choose from a number of films, but as I said, they kind of rotate. But
I like to fly fish, but I'm not going to drive to Missouri to watch a movie about
that. Well, that's the beauty of the Internet. You don't need to travel anywhere. As a member, you can just click right on the screening room from your computer and watch any of the films that we have in our library.
I'm going to look that up. I've been a member for so many years, but I never knew that was available. So.
Was one of the compelling reasons for me to join was just the amount of material that's available to the membership. It's really cool.
Yeah,
I would agree.
Ever-evolving. So, In serving as curator, are you involved in the design of your exhibits or suggesting topics? How does a display come to be at the museum?
Well, the nice thing about working at the museum, there's just a tremendous collection of people there, and I can't say enough good about the people that I get to work with every day. They're just terrific. So there's no such thing as one person coming up with an idea. We bounce ideas off each other all the time. When it comes to selecting some of the artifacts, they may look to me for some of the history and perhaps writing a description or two, but certainly not being a scholar, I depend on other people to to neaten up my the words that I use. And then as far as design, again, we'll do quite a bit of work together to come up with the best design. We'll bounce ideas off of each other. So when it came to the most recent exhibit, which involves both Lee and Joan Wolfe, it's an exhibit called Tied Together, we all kind of worked on the idea behind the exhibit, how best to present it. I chose a number of the artifacts, and we worked on how best to present those, how to lay them out. Once we get all the graphics and all the text and put it all together and see how it all fits together, and it kind of forms into an exhibit. And I have to say, I'm very, very proud of the work that we all did to bring that to the public.
That's super exciting. And, an obvious benefit of collaboration and, to your point, having fun people to bounce ideas off of and, you know, vice versa. So, well, as you've opened the door to that exhibit with Joan and Lee, maybe tell us a little bit about that. I think we were talking off air. Ms. Wolf was with you guys Monday night, wasn't she?
I'm sorry, you cut out a little bit there.
Oh, I'm sorry. was Joan with you Monday night for the Nancy's induction?
Yes, she was. Joan was able to connect via Zoom from her home and join the panel discussion, and I was fortunate enough to spend some time with Joan on Monday to help her get all that set up and make sure that she had a successful event. So, yeah, I got to spend time with Joan, and that all goes back to opportunities to share in events like this with people like Joan Wolf, who I otherwise would never have had an opportunity to meet. She's just an amazing person, and I'm very grateful to have gotten to know her. She's a remarkable woman with an even more remarkable history in fly fishing.
Awesome. Awesome. Well, as a fun coincidence, we're going to be speaking with her later today and recording a short podcast. So listeners will tease that and leave that be. But aside from the obvious with the wolves, what are some of the other things the museum are offering these days?
So at our Manchester campus, we currently have a number of other exhibits. In the main gallery, we have an exhibit titled Reflections, and that includes a number of pieces from our extensive art collection. And it traces the history through art of fly fishing, giving an idea of what people used to wear, how they used to fish, some of the environments that they found themselves in. It really is a timeline through artwork of the evolution of fly fishing, and it's a really fun exhibit. And in the middle of the exhibit, we have a number of cases that include artifacts dating back to the earliest times in America for fishing. Some of the first fly reels, rods, some of the awards that were earned as a result of some of the inventions by some of the rod reel makers, and fly tires, all the way up to some more contemporary pieces such as some of the earliest fiberglass rods, some of the more contemporary saltwater tackle that took a lot of years to develop, and that's all in the main gallery. We have a pretty extensive library on our second floor in the main campus. It's our Gardner Grant Library. We were very fortunate recently to receive a rather large donation from Mr. Thatcher that includes several hundred titles that go back, 1500s all the way to 1900s. There's some remarkable volumes in that collection. One of the most remarkable for me is the second edition of a book that was written by a gentleman named Thomas Barker. Barker's book was the first to make mention of a fishing reel in the English language in 1651. And in his second edition in 1657, he offered the first line drawing of a fishing reel. So that's all pretty remarkable stuff. So of course we have that research library that people are can use for whatever research they're doing. Oh, let's see, we have another exhibit called In Real Time, and that gives examples that date back to the 1800s all the way up to the most recent edition, which is a 3D printed plastic reel by a gentleman named Michael Hackney. So you can imagine that there's some pretty unique examples in there.
I'm actually intimate with that design, as I had printed that myself about 5 years ago.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah, super clever. I will confess I've not fished it, but it was a little project.
Well, you know you can fish with it. That's what they're made for.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. Well, a topic for another day. But anywho, to that end, what are there certain exhibits or displays that kind of not necessarily in place now, but perhaps over the course of time, or personalities contained within displays that you find intriguing personally?
I think all of the exhibits are intriguing. Truly, I do. Even some of the other. Some of the other things we have on exhibit currently, there's a little exhibit. Well, I call it little. It's actually comprehensive. It's called Smoke Signals, and it's about the cigarette cards from the 20th century. So when you bought a pack of cigarettes, just like when you bought baseball cards, you'd get a little premium. You'd get the gum and that sort of thing. With the cigarette sales, you would get a little card that featured game fish. And there's a collection of all of the game fish that were included in all those cards. In fact, there was a book produced from that. That's a great little exhibit. We have another exhibit of some of the earliest Orvis fly rods that were associated with the owner, Lee Perkins. We also have one of the coolest looking exhibits. It's called Turbulence and Flow. And it's the artwork of Val Kropnowicki. He is a hook maker and a fly maker with some really unique designs that are just, I mean, the aesthetics are off the charts. So I find all of this stuff fascinating. There's something to be learned with every exhibit that we do.
I like it. Well, as we discussed, I'm certainly looking forward to making a trip out there sooner than later. So, you've just underscored a whole slew of other reasons to come visit.
I would encourage everyone to come out to the museum. It really is a wonderful place. And of course, we do introduce new exhibits from time to time. If you go to the museum's website, amff.org, you'll be able to see a list of current exhibits. And so you'll know exactly what's on display at the time you'll come. And if anyone has any questions about the exhibits, certainly if I'm on hand, I'd be happy to answer any questions anyone has. And if they happen to have questions about our space in Missouri, I'm happy to answer those as well.
Nice. Well, and I'm going to go ahead and pluck your brain a little bit here. From the personality perspective, tell me about this lady known as Fly Rod Crosby.
Happy to. So part of an exhibit that the museum had up for a few years ago was called The Graceful Rise, and that exhibit centered on some of the women that have been influential in the sport of fly fishing. And Cornelia Crosby, otherwise known as Fly Rod, was certainly an integral part of that history. She was born in Maine, a small town near Rangeley Lakes region, and she, as an adult, worked for some of the railroads in Maine, and she was friends with a gentleman named Charles Wheeler, and Mr. Wheeler was a rod maker, a pretty well-known rod maker in that area, and both Cornelia and Mr. Wheeler became friends. She started using some of his rods, so she became a very avid angler, a successful one at that, so much so that she started writing for the local newspaper. and she would talk about some of the fishing trips. And the editor of the newspaper asked her to do a regular column. And she submitted those under the name of Fly Rod, starting in 1889. So now she had an outlet for all of her stories, which were immensely popular amongst the readers. She also, at the time, was working for the Maine Central Railroad. And she understood that using that railroad would be able to introduce other people to the good fishing in that area. So she actually convinced the Maine Railroad to sponsor an exhibition at the Sportsman's Expo that they would hold in New York City. And I have to say, when she prompted them to do this, they did it right. They reproduced a Maine cabin in the woods at that exposition. So if you can imagine, they constructed a log cabin in New York City, resembling something from Maine, complete with deer mounts and fish mounts and all the gear and the boats. And so it was a pretty unique exhibit, and certainly caught the attention of a lot of people.
I mean, that's a pretty ambitious undertaking in that at that point in time, right?
Oh, it was. But you know, I have to say that that was something that that people did back then when it came to these exhibitions. The people that were producing these products and endorsing the fishing in an area, they were very passionate about what they did, and they didn't do things halfway. So they when they put their effort into it, they really went over and above and beyond to see that exhibit. In fact, one of the most recent acquisitions at the museum, we were very fortunate to have a reel, talking about the Martin Automatic reel a little while ago. We have a reel that was presented to Fly Rod Crosby from the Martin Automatic Company. And it's inscribed to Fly Rod, and it depicts an angler etched into the little winding plate on top of the reel. And, of course, they were both in attendance at one of those New York expos, and I'm sure that was an interaction, and Martin decided to produce a reel for Fly Rod, which we're very fortunate to have. The other thing that's remarkable about Fly Rod, she not only endorsed the fishing in that area, but she understood that conservation was very important and that something needed to be done to preserve that fishery. So she actually lobbied to have guides in Maine pay a fee with the monies raised for that going to conservation. And for her efforts, in 1897, she learned via a telegraph that motion passed. And by way of thanking Fly Rod, the state of Maine issued her a ceremonial license, number one, in 1898.
That's pretty cool.
Jim,
was it known to her readers that she was a female?
Yes.
And that makes it twice as cool then. I didn't know if Fly Rod was to gain acceptance and credibility or just as a nickname.
They would publish her, the photographs of Fly Rod, showed her in her full, I'm just going to, for lack of a better term, female garb. She would wear those long skirts. Some views, her skirts were not quite long enough. She would show her ankles, and in the 1800s, I guess that was a big no-no. But when you're traversing the terrain around Rangeley Lakes, Maine, you've got to be a little careful about what you wear.
Yeah, well,
in fact,
when you're that far out in the woods, I don't think the deer or the moose mind.
Yeah. I don't think they really care. That's right.
She had kind of an unfortunate end, though, didn't she? She fell off a train or something.
Well, you know, and that's just, I was just going to mention that there are, by some accounts, talk about her disembarking from a train, and they think that her skirt actually played a part in her falling, having an accident, and from that time forward, unfortunately, it severely curtailed her activities in the woods. So her column became more about some of her remembrances of events past, and ultimately led to her not getting to the outdoors at all.
It's terribly unfortunate. Yeah.
Yeah, but she lived a remarkable life and certainly had an influence on a tremendous number of people, and certainly the fishing in Rangeley Lakes, which by all accounts is spectacular. But the conservation efforts from Cornelia went a long way to preserving that. So they understood early on that that was important.
Was there a pass off or a legacy? Was there something that, outside of obviously the whole thing that we're talking about, did she pass her conservation passion along to anybody immediately thereafter?
I don't know that there's anyone you could put your finger on to say that there was a direct influence or that there was one person. It was more of a movement. And in fact, people like Lee Wolf and Joan Wolf, when they got together, both of them certainly moved that forward. Lee Wolf was known for his efforts in conservation. Joan was right there at his side promoting the same things. Joan actually still, and I'm sure she'd be happy to talk to you about some of the efforts with the Atlantic Salmon Federation that both she and Lee were big proponents of, again, all to preserve those fish. There's a number of quotes from Lee Wolf that are still repeated today about a game fish being too valuable to be caught just once.
Right.
So, yeah, you know, conservation was certainly moved forward from people like Fly Rod Crosby all the way up into today. So.
And what was his trick of the phrase, the best gift you can give another angler is to put the fish back?
That's absolutely correct. That's right. And who's to say that the fish you caught wasn't a gift from someone else before? Yep. Yep. Yes, that's correct.
Yeah. Awesome. Well, did we do enough real talk?
Well, don't ask me that question. I can ramble on about reels for days.
Too much real talk?
No, not as far as I'm concerned. No, not for me. Yeah, so the reels that that I'm passionate about and what got me started down the path were some of the reels from William Billinghurst. Billinghurst was a gunsmith from the Rochester, New York area, and if pressed, you would ask me earlier on if there's a favorite that I have.
Yeah.
I would probably have to name the Billinghurst reel as being my absolute favorite for a lot of reasons, not the least of which his patented fly reel from 1859 was the first patented fly reel in the United States. And it's very unique looking. For those that are unfamiliar, it's what's called today a birdcage reel. So it doesn't really look like anything that you've seen today in that it was not a solid side-plated reel. The spool was made up of 20 individual rings that surrounded a central disc. The purpose of that was that so the horsehair and silk fly lines of the day could dry while they were still in the reel. A common problem for fly anglers, or all anglers back in the 1800s, because the lines were made out of horsehair, gut, and that sort of thing, at the end of a day's fishing, if you didn't remove your line from the reel and allow it to dry, it would rot. So by having an open spool design, Billinghurst was able to keep the line on the reel and have enough air exposure so that it would dry while it was still on a reel.
Good idea.
Yeah, that was an important thing back then. The other thing that his reel did, the multiplying reel, although its origins can be traced back to England, really became popular in the States back in the 1820s with the invention of the Kentucky reel by a gentleman named George Snyder. It was later taken up by clockmakers J.F. and B.F. Meek with the multiplying reel. But when Billinghurst invented his reel, he could achieve the same retrieve ratio minus gears. And he did that by using a very a large central disc and had those rings installed on the periphery. That allowed the retrieval of a lot of line with the single turn of the handle. So he had a fast retrieve reel that could dry your line. And then lastly, it was different from all the other reels at the time. It was mounted on its side. So it was a horizontally mounted reel on the rod. And you know, that may not be all that remarkable, but when you took that reel off of the rod at the end of the day, you could slip it in your coat pocket.
That was a Kentucky reel?
No, the Kentucky reels were more of a quote-unquote standard reel with side plates, a wide spool. If you were to put that in your pocket, it's a little bit bulky. The side-mounted reels from New York State, again, had a very low profile. When you took it off of the rod, you could simply slide it into your pocket. Now,
wow.
notice I didn't say your vest pocket. The fly fishing vest, of course, wasn't invented until Lee Wolf brought it to everyone's attention in the 1930s.
Right. Well, at that point, slip it into the pocket of your tweed coat.
Exactly, yep. So, and there were others that followed suit. In 1866, there was a gentleman from New Haven, Connecticut named Anson Hatch. He patented his reel in 1866. After that, other notable side mount reels included something from Dr. Alonzo Fowler. His reel, I think, is really interesting because it was made completely out of hard rubber. So Dr. Fowler was a dentist in Batavia, New York, and the molding technology that he used for people's teeth, he used that molding technology to make a fishing reel. And it's terrific in terms of reducing the amount of weight on your rod, but it was also as fragile as a brittle egg. If you drop that on the rocks, it would just simply break. As a result, there aren't too many of those left in collections. They're pretty rare.
When you talk about that material, is that like a bakelite or an ebonite type of hard, almost plastic?
Yeah, it's the vulcanization rubber, which was invented by Goodyear, of course, a few years before Dr. Fowler molded his first reel. But yes, it was actually a hard rubber substance, not so much like bakelite. Bakelite was more of a resin, but this was actually hard rubber.
Okay. I'm just trying. And thanks for indulging me. I was trying to visualize that. That's amazing. Yeah. So, not much left of in terms of marketability. Given the material?
There were actually quite a few anglers back then that endorsed his reel in particular, probably because it was so light. Dr. Fowler was also a rod builder. He probably gained more popularity for his rods than his reels. The reels only lasted for a few years. There was another gentleman named Charles Clinton that kind of improved upon Dr. Fowler's invention. In 1889, he came out and the patent office granted him a patent for his version of a side-mounted reel, which looked identical to Dr. Fowler's, except that it was made out of German silver and had a little internal oil reservoir to keep it lubricated.
Oh, really?
Yep.
That's kind of cool. Yeah.
And the side-mounted reels lasted for a little while. It's notable that the number one reason for their kind of quote-unquote demise came in 1874 when Charles F. Orvis introduced his patented fly reel. The Orvis reel was similar in style to the Billingers, except it mounted vertically. It was a very narrow spool reel and had just a tremendous number of perforations on the side plates, again, all in an attempt to dry the line while it was still on the reel. That reel, that design, and the popularity just completely took off. So the side-mounted fly reels by 1900 were just about completely out of favor, except for the automatic fly reels. They stayed side-mounted, oh boy, all the way up into the 1980s.
That's fascinating. That's fascinating. Now, Jim, as a collector, do you ever mount one of these on a rod and fish it?
I have. I've caught a reel using a Billinghurst fly reel mounted on a rod. I had to try it at least once. You know, the thing to keep in mind is all of these inventors and makers, and this is particularly true of the gentlemen that make and spend just a tremendous amount of time handcrafting fly rods, they all want their products to be used. If you were to tell Mr. Billinghurst, Mr. Garrison, or any contemporary rod maker that you want to buy their rod simply so you can put it up on a shelf, they really wouldn't like to hear that. They want to know that the things that they're passionate about, the things that they're producing, they want to know that people are using it and enjoying it. And as difficult as it can be for some collectors, it's okay to use something, provided it's not going to cause it any harm. If it's structurally sound, I think it's okay to use.
Yeah, I agree. It's a lot more fun to do it than to just have it in a closet or on a shelf, to your point.
Yeah. But, now, let's face it, there are some exceptions to that. I don't think anybody's going to fault the museum for not wanting Ernest Hemingway's Hardy fly rod. We're never going to put that in the hands of an angler. I'm sorry, that's just not going to happen.
Okay, well, I'll scratch that off my list of things I was I got there. Yeah, very well then. Well, Jim, this has been a treat. You've been most generous with your time, and you're an excellent ambassador for the museum, and thank you so much. Really appreciate you sharing your time and your knowledge with us.
Anytime, gentlemen. I appreciate your interest, and I'm happy to answer any questions. As I said, if anyone has any, you can find my contact information from the museum's website. And again, I encourage people to join the museum and certainly come on up and visit us either in Manchester or in Springfield and enjoy yourselves.
Well, and we'll put your info in the show notes so the listeners can check that out. So, Jim, thank you, sir. Good luck this spring, and I hope you have a successful season on the water.
Yeah, thanks for coming up.
Well, I hope you guys enjoyed that. Jim's a fun guy and definitely a wealth of knowledge. So, regular museum hours this week, 11 to 3. And if you're in the neighborhood, please stop by. If you happen to be up and want to take a tour and can't make it on Saturday, drop us an email and we'll be happy to open the museum for you and your party. So there we have it. Until next time, mind your back, cast.